which on Sundays we are reviewing everything that we're reading. So I have the daily Bible reading schedule. Last week we finished surveying through 1 Chronicles chapter 27 through 29. That's the last three chapters of 1 Chronicles. And so starting on Monday, our reading began in 2 Chronicles chapter 1. And you can see today is the 24th. We will review through chapter 25 today. Now we're going to do part of that this morning. And then the rest of that we will do in our special audio file that we will send out for what would normally be our PM Bible study after our devotion. So we have 25 chapters that we're going to cover. That's pretty much consistent with where we've been. Each time we review, we're doing 10 to 12 chapters each session. And so we're going to take up the 2 Chronicles chapter 1 in just a little bit. So I'm going to segue from the daily Bible reading schedule to our notes on 1 and 2 Chronicles. So let me bring them up to speed with where we need to be. This is at the end of 1 Chronicles chapter 24. We need to go a little bit further into our notes. All right, I don't know that we reviewed everything last time in our Sunday morning class, but I think I did so in the Sunday evening material that I provided. But let's just note a few things that we will want to mention about 1 Chronicles in review. Remember, the books of history, Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, all six of those books, as we have them in our present Bible translations, deal with roughly the same period of time. It starts at the end of the period of Judges, with Samuel as the last of the judges, and the beginning of the United Kingdom, with Saul being anointed by Samuel, and then later David. And then it goes through the life of David and his reign as king, that of Solomon, the division that takes place during Solomon's son. Remember, the first 10 chapters of 1 Kings are very, very positive until you get to the 11th chapter, where Solomon's sins of not only marrying many women, but allowing them to move him away from devoted worship and dedicated worship of God. And then the kingdom divides as a result of that, not during the life of Solomon, but for the sake of his father, but during the life of his son, Rehoboam. And then the rest of the books of Kings and 2 Kings chronicles a gradual decline. The northern kingdom starts on a bad foot, worshiping false images in Dan and Bethel, instituted by Jeroboam, son of Nebat. And it continues to spiral downhill throughout their history. They go into captivity about 722, 723 BC. 116 years later, the southern kingdom goes into captivity. And that's where 2 Kings ends. There is allusion to the period of restoration at the end of that. The Chronicles focuses on the same period of history, but from a very different perspective. In our Sunday morning worship services, we focused twice on Chronicles, emphasizing key elements. The first time, how different Chronicles is. At the same time, it's the same. 50% of 50% of Chronicles comes from the writings of Samuel and Kings, but 50% of it's unique, and it's that unique part that we wanted to emphasize in that lesson. And so it focuses on the unity of Israel, the worship that Israel is supposed to be involved in. And so there are lots of parallels between the text, but they're not identical. We mentioned, for example, the parallels Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, how they're not identical, but they are parallel. The emphasis is on positive elements in Israel's history. And so that's why the two kings that are accentuated in the writings of Chronicles, David and Solomon, are all over the place. Why David and Solomon? Weren't they sinners? Yes. Didn't they make lots of mistakes? Oh, yeah. But they're emphasized because it was during a period of time when the kingdom was united. And the kingdom was united behind David and Solomon, and it's not going to be divided till later, that we already noted. So there's an emphasis on the united kingdom, everybody in Israel participating in that united kingdom. And in large measure, during the time of David and the beginning of Solomon's time, they were united in their system of worship. All right, so let's get into the books of 2 Chronicles. Again, we're going to look through the first 10 or 12 chapters. We may not look through it in as intense survey as we would like. We usually do a little bit more on our Sunday evening surveys because we don't have the same time constraints that we do on our Sunday morning survey. But if you have your Bibles open, you might turn to 2 Chronicles and just kind of watch the highlights as we present them on the screen going forward. Just a reminder, all the books, Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, each of them were initially a unit. In fact, Samuel and Kings, both of those segments, that is, all four of those books were initially together. So, very simply, Book of Second Chronicles, originally part of the book which bore the name Chronicles. Usually it refers to that which is remaining, that's from the Hebrew title. Since it's been divided into two parts, probably because of the size of the scrolls that would have taken to contain all of them, and it was easier to do them in two sections. Previously mentioned, much of the material that we see here is found in the books of Samuel and Kings, roughly 50%. So what we saw during the first part of the two books focused on the building of the temple. Huge, huge emphasis on the generosity of David, the collection of materials, and the donation of national funds, the donation of personal funds, and the donation of individuals' funds to the building of the temple. And then the temple is going to be built during the time of Solomon, which we're about to get into, Second Chronicles. So David is going to die at the end of First Chronicles. Solomon is anointed. It does not discuss the challenge of Adonijah in this context. We see that in 1 Kings. Again, remember, it's not glossing over things, but it's emphasizing unity of the nation of Israel. So Solomon is going to be come the next king. Verse 1, we see Solomon, the son of David, was strengthened in his kingdom, and the Lord his God was with him and exalted him exceedingly. Now, that's not intended to be a summary of everything about Solomon's life, but it is a point of emphasis in the book of Chronicles, especially from the standpoint of unity and worship. Solomon goes up with the congregation to the altar of the Lord to offer sacrifice. This is after the building project. The huge building project is detailed in lots of chapters in 1 Kings. All the materials that gather together, the work of Hiram, king of Tyre, who's involved in supplying materials and workmen, and the ornate way in which it was built, all the stones on the outside covered with cedar and cypress on the inside, all of which was covered with gold. All of that's mentioned in the context of 1 Kings. So in this chapter, Solomon is already going to the congregation, before the congregation, the altar of the Lord, to offer sacrifices, and huge, huge number of sacrifices that were offered at the dedication of the temple. Just a reminder, when the tabernacle was dedicated at Mount Sinai, the presence of the Lord filled the most holy place, that is, the innermost part of the tabernacle, and the same thing's going to happen in the context of the temple. Solomon, in thanking God for the mercy showed to his father, that he was a king and that he is able to continue in that kingly line. That promise in 2 Samuel chapter 7 was that there was going to be a king continuing on the throne of David, ultimately into eternity. There's a caveat there. Jeremiah says nobody was going to sit on the literal throne of David past a certain king. That's brought out in Jeremiah in chapter 22, I believe it is. But Jesus is going to sit upon the eternal throne. Luke chapter 1 verses 30 and following talk about that. So he showed, expressed mercy for his father, asked the Lord to grant him, that is Solomon, wisdom. If you read back in Kings, you'll see he says, I'm a child, and you have given me this incredibly great nation to guide. I need to know how to do so. And God grants him not only wisdom and knowledge, but also because he did not ask for riches, God grants him that as well. Verses 2 through 13, last section of the chapter, talks about the wealth and the strength of the king. Just very quickly, a lot of the territorial expansion that took place during the time of David as king, during the 40 years of his United Kingdom, a lot of the territorial expansion took place as a result of military conquest, specifically inaugurated and continued by David. Solomon is not mentioned in either Kings or Chronicles as a warrior or as a military leader. He's more a businessman, a statesman, a politician, if you will. And so that does not mean the kingdom did not continue expanding. It did, but it wasn't as a result of so much military effort, at least not as directed specifically by Solomon. He did maintain a huge army. And for a large part of his time as a king over the United Kingdom, there were no challenges to Israel's authority. There were no constant burrs in their saddle, thorns in the saddle, like we had the Philistines and others during the time of Saul and the time of David.
Screen is sideways. It's
supposed to be.
Well, it's coming up sideways.
That's a problem I've had before.
Have you?
Huh?
Okay.
I've had that before. It's supposed to start this way. I'll have to fix that later.
Okay.
So thanks for telling me. I appreciate it, George.
It was a message from your wife.
Yeah. Thanks. I've done this before when I did a trial last night for a few seconds at work, but for some reason it's got a hiccup, hitching its get along. I'll fix that later. I can download it and straighten it out. So, meanwhile, if you're watching live, just turn your head sideways. I apologize for that. That's the second time I've had that happen. All right. So, rest of the chapter talks about Solomon's military and economic power. Notice that's not because he is a warrior, but it's because of the size of the army that he had. And it's also because of the incredible arrangements that he had with other countries who were paying tribute to him. 2 Chronicles in the second chapter goes into what we saw before in 1 Kings about the construction of the temple. Whole chapter talks about the Solomon and Solomon's preparation to build the temple, all the men that are appointed to do the work. He works with Hiram, whom his father also worked with, the king of Tyre, with reference to the craftsmanship, that is, workmen who are going to build the temple, and also the materials that are going to be required. Hiram is involved in supplying both of those. So Hiram supplying Solomon with all this help, and we see in the books of Kings it talks about payment that was given to Hiram in the form of cities. So I'm not going to go into all of the details of this, but it says he's going to build the temple for the Lord and a royal house for himself. Hiram is involved in both of those, and we see the communication that goes back and forth between Hiram and Solomon in that chapter, and letters to one, letters to the other, and Solomon gathers all of these individuals, lots of people, if you look at the number that's brought out in verses 17 and following, all those who are going to be involved in it. Notice the last part of it, even 70,000 people, just bearers of burdens, 80,000 hewers of stone, 3,600 overseers who are going to be involved in the work. The third chapter actually discusses the building of the temple. And again, these things were already mentioned in 1 Kings. And so remember, Chronicles duplicates. 50% of the material in Chronicles comes from Samuel and Kings. And we see the actual building process come to place. All the stones that were hewn were brought into place in the temple proper, and there wasn't any noise of tools being used then because of the way they had been shaped and formed and prepared to fit together when they came to this place. Notice it was to be built in Jerusalem at Mount Moriah, and we don't see this in this context, but we saw it in 1 Chronicles, that when David in the end of 2 Samuel 24, when he numbered the armies of Israel, something that God did not want him to do, and a plague came upon Israel as a result. Even Joab was hesitant to do that. But in order to stay the plague, he was directed by the angel of Jehovah to go to the threshing floor of Araunah and to offer sacrifice in order to stay that plague. And when Chronicles reflects on that, in 1 Chronicles, it was there that David determined that the temple mount would be, that the temple would be located. And so the plague stayed in 2 Samuel chapter 24, the threshing floor of Araunah, becomes the ground zero, so to speak, of the building of the temple. So it mentions here that he had purchased that from Araunah. Remember, Araunah says, I will give you the land, I will give you the altar, I will give you the sacrifice, I'll provide everything for you, perhaps just in deferring to David as king. And David said he couldn't do that. He could not offer to God that which cost him nothing. And so David purchases an offering sacrifice there, and that's going to be where the temple is going to be built. So if you read starting in chapter 1, all the things that David prepared at the threshing floor, that's the ground zero point, that's the foundation point, and then all the materials that David had collected, the monies that David had given, and so forth, all of that's going to be mentioned in this chapter. The measurements of the temple are provided. It's larger than the tabernacle. Just for instance, the tabernacle, most holy place, was 10 by 10 by 10 cubits. This is 20 by 20 by 20. Each of them doubled, makes it 8 times the size. And the rest of the temple was larger as well. All of these things are listed, how all the stones come together, and inside of that was the cypress and the cedar that we mentioned before, and everything being overlaid with gold. All of those details are given in chapter 3, so we're not going to go through that again. We saw that when we were surveying 1 Kings. Chapter 4, continuing discussion of everything that's in the tabernacle, this time the furnishings, not just the building proper. Again, this is repetition from what we see in the books of Kings. So the altar that was used, the sea, that is the labor that was used, thickness of it, the diameter of it, the size of it, how much water it could hold, the lampstands, all of those things are spelled out in detail in the fourth chapter of 2 Chronicles. Chapter 5, the Ark of the Covenant comes into the temple in chapter 5. Just a reminder, one of the things that we saw during David's life was he intended to build a house for God. God says, you can't. 2 Samuel chapter 7, he says, but rather than you building me a house, I'm going to build a house for you. And the house that he built was not a physical house. David already had a house of cedar. And that's what prompted him. He said, I live in a house of cedar, and God lives in a tent, referring to where the ark was. Remember, we saw the incident of Uzzah when they initially attempted to move the ark into the tabernacle, and it failed because Uzzah reached out and touched it. That's because it wasn't moved according to the due order. Chronicles tells us about that. Later, it comes and is placed in this tabernacle, much of which we don't know about. That is, there's a lot about this tabernacle we don't know. What did it look like? Was it set up after the order of the original tabernacle at Mount Sinai? Those details aren't specified in either Kings or Chronicles, and it's not because it's not important, but it's incidental to the greater plan of moving place of worship of God to the city of Jerusalem and anticipation of the permanent place where God's presence was said to dwell, and that is in the temple. And so the ark now moves from that temporary tabernacle that David had built after he moved the ark from the house of Kirjath-Jearim, where it had been for a number of times, from the city of Kirjath-Jearim in the house of Amminadab, where it had been for many years, and moves it to the city of Jerusalem. Now it moves from the temporary tabernacle that David built, and it's going to move into the temple proper. So that's going to be brought out in chapter 5. So chapter 5 opens in verse 1 with the completion of everything. It was done, it was finished, everything's brought together, the silver, the gold, all the treasuries and so forth. Now, this is summing up years of work. When you go back into 1 Kings and you see the discussion that's presented there, the tens of thousands of workmen didn't labor just a couple of days. This was over multiple years that the process is going to be completed. So that's summed up very quickly by saying, it's all done now. Now we're going to start moving everything in and we're going to start the system of worship that God had started back at Sinai. So the ark is now within the temple. It's going to be filled with a cloud, verses 13 and 14, symbolizing the presence of God in the most holy place. Same act, of course, occurred in the concluding chapter of Exodus chapter 40. When you read through the book of Exodus, a huge segment of the book, I think about a third of it, is all devoted to description of the tabernacle, those who are involved in giving for the tabernacle, the workmen for the tabernacle, the ultimate setup of the tabernacle, and finally the tabernacle beginning to be used as a place of worship, the last chapter. So it's that last chapter, chapter 40, when it's completed, that the same thing happens there. The presence of God fills the tabernacle. And so the same thing is going to happen here. The presence of God indicating that God lives among the children of Israel. The book of Leviticus, coming after Exodus, obviously, talks about all of the things that Israel was to do so that they would, I'm going to use this word, qualify so that God could be in their midst. I don't mean anything negative there. It's not like they're earning God's presence. But God says, here are the conditions that you must do in order for me to be your God, in order for you to be my people. All the sacrificial system, the Levitical system, all those details are spelled out there. That was all requisite. That was all required for God to live in the tabernacle. The same sort of thing is going to be spelled out with reference to God to dwell in the permanent facility that is the temple. We say permanent, even though we know it's going to be destroyed hundreds of years later, and then rebuilt, and then finally destroyed again. That is the second incarnation of it in 70 AD. And so God's presence was there. Just a reminder or anticipation of what we'll see in the future when we get into Jeremiah. Jeremiah encountered people who did not believe that God was going to leave them. The people, in effect, said, that can't possibly happen. God lives in the temple on the hill, that is, on the Temple Mount, Araunah, the threshing floor of Araunah, at Mount Moriah. God lives there. And if God lives there, nothing's ever going to happen to us because God lives in that house. When we go to the book of Ezekiel, one of two exilic prophets, that is a prophet during the midst of the exile, the other one being Daniel, Ezekiel has the dubious job description of telling the children of Israel, we're now in captivity in Babylon, 20 years after the first carrying away in 606, so this is about 586, that the city of Jerusalem is destroyed and the temple is no more. He says, God's not there anymore, because it's not there anymore. So the presence of God left the temple, moves outside of the temple, over the outside the walls of the city of Jerusalem, and over the hills and far away, so to speak. And so God's presence in the temple did not guarantee that God was always going to be with Israel. They assumed that God's presence there was going to be perpetual. That is, it's going to be ongoing, and he will never, ever leave us, and nothing bad will ever happen to us. That, of course, is not what we see in the books of Kings. Chronicles doesn't emphasize that. Chronicles is emphasizing repentance and restoration. Repentance and restoration. And the continued presence of God on an ongoing basis for those who are involved in the restoration, starting with the work of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. And so this is the start of the permanent dwelling place. And again, we've already qualified the meaning of the word permanent there. So the work is completed in verse 1. Solomon gets all the elders, all the people from the tribes of Israel, gathers them together. They're going to have a great feast in the seventh month. All the Levites come and they take up the ark in the appropriate way. And they brought up the ark from the tabernacle of meeting and all the furnishings that were in the tabernacle. That's the one that David had set up when it was brought there. And they brought them up and they're going to move them into the permanent place. All right, so they're moving them from the temporary location that David had established and moving them into the temple itself. And so as they're doing all of these things, as it's moving, there's a constant stream, it seems, of sacrifices that are being offered in order to dedicate, in order to consecrate the new temple. So they bring the Ark of the Covenant, put it in its place in the inner sanctuary, the most holy place, that is that perfect cube of 20 by 20 by 20, under the wings of the cherubim, which was over the Ark of the Covenant. And the cherubim spread their wings and it touched in the center and touched the walls on either side, as it did in the tabernacle. So this is different because of the size. That is a different one. And so they could only be moved in on the poles, and they were visible, according to what we see in verse 9, from the outside. And that's where they are to this day. Nothing, and this is an interesting sidelight. I don't want to get into too much about it. But it says, nothing in the ark except the two tablets which Moses put there at Horeb when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they'd come out of Egypt. What happened to the other items? Don't know. There was a supply of manna that had been put there, symbolizing God's providence for them, and Aaron's rod that budded, and they're not there. Who removed them? Did God remove them? Those details aren't mentioned. Just as a side note, when the children of Israel, during the time that Samuel was a prophet and Saul was a king, they determined to take the, let me make sure that's correct, that may be before Saul became a king, they took the Ark of the Covenant into battle against the Philistines as if it were going to be some kind of lucky charm, you know, a lucky rabbit's foot, a four-leaf clover, say, we're not going to be defeated, we've got the Ark of the Covenant with us. There's nothing in the text that tells us God ever told anybody to do that, but that's what they did. When the noise that they made attracted the attention of the Philistines, and they realized, oh, their God was coming with them into battle because they're taking the Ark of the Covenant. But it backfired. Yeah.
The Bible says that the Ark went before them.
Yes. And so, they assumed it was going to help them in battle. But the Philistines redoubled their efforts, so to speak, and not only defeated the children of Israel, but they captured the Ark. And so remember, it was there for a while among the Philistines, traveled among some of the great cities of the Philistines, and everywhere that it was kept, it caused havoc among those people. The temple of Dagon fell over, and so forth. So they finally send it back, and it comes to the people of Beth Shemesh, and they open the Ark of the Covenant, and many people died as a result. Well, did they take anything there? The text doesn't tell us. But it shouldn't have been open. So the items that are remaining here are different than what was initially there. So we are not told what happened to the contents of the ark. Incidentally, EMZER, and I don't remember what E and M stand for, restorationist preacher and commentator from many years ago, has a 6-volume commentary on the Old Testament, the New Testament. I believe it's on the whole Bible. And he does an exceptional job in tracing the ark from place to place and keeping track of where it moved. So if you ever get a copy of that commentary, it has a history of all the movements of the ark and deals with some of these details. So what happened? We don't know. We're not told. So when they did all of these things, they offered all the sacrifices, they brought all the singers in, and the whole celebration of the movement of the ark from the tabernacle into the temple is going to be finished. And then the house of the Lord is filled with a cloud, verses 13. So the priests could not continue ministering because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. And that's what it was intended to be. It was intended to be God's dwelling place during the time in the tabernacle in the wilderness and in Shiloh when they came into the land. Now the tabernacle in the city of Jerusalem is the worship center, segues to the temple in the city of Jerusalem. So chapter 6, and again, repetition, 50%. We repeat this constantly because there's a lot of repetition in Chronicles. We've seen 50% of this before. In the writings of Samuel and Kings. And so Solomon addresses the people. There are a couple of addresses by Solomon that we see recorded in Kings. Solomon addresses the congregation of Israel, blesses them, gives thanks to the Lord for the temple. Mention is made about God's care for Israel ever since they left the land of Egypt. So there's a history lesson here. God delivered them from bondage and brought them into freedom, the land of Canaan. So he takes them out of the bad and takes them into the good, the land flowing with milk and honey, the way it's often described. And so Solomon makes reference to that. It's interesting the number of times at key events, especially in sermons in the book of Acts, in which every sermon begins with a history lesson, going back to this person or that person, key person in history, going back to Abraham or going back to David or going back to the prophets or freedom from Egypt. And so the same thing takes place here. Chronicles does history really large when you see the genealogies in the first 9 chapters of First Chronicles. It goes all the way back to Adam, as Luke does in Luke chapter 3. So it's to be totally inclusive of everything that's happened in God's plan to redeem mankind through Israel. Not just Israel, but mankind through Israel, specifically through the Messiah, born of the tribe of Judah. And so that's constantly addressed. So the opening chapter, Solomon addresses the congregation, gives thanks to God and for the temple, gives an overview of the history ever since they left the land of Egypt, mention of all the fulfillment of promises that God made, specifically with reference to Solomon becoming king, 2 Samuel 7, David was promised that, and also with reference to the building of the temple. Last portion, and it's rather lengthy, about 31 verses, a record of the prayer that Solomon offers at the dedication of the temple. Just a reminder, David committed to Solomon two very huge principles and mandates, so to speak, wishes, hopes, desires, not just David's, but God's coming through David towards Solomon. One, be faithful in word. Two, be faithful in worship. As David was faithful in word and devotion to it, we see that reflected a lot in the Psalms, and worship, especially with reference to the move of the ark to the tabernacle in Jerusalem, and also hopes to build a temple. And that's what David conveyed to Solomon. And that's what Solomon was in the beginning. We don't see until after the 10th chapter, 1 Kings, where that falls apart. That's not mentioned in Chronicles. That's not highlighted. All the problems of David, they're not highlighted in Chronicles. All the problems of Solomon aren't highlighted in Chronicles. And so Solomon's prayer in Kings and also in the context of Chronicles is very, very powerful and very, very positive. What's it about? Notice we highlighted here, ask the Lord to continue to keep his promises, which God's going to do. God's always faithful to himself, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 13. God's going to be faithful to his promises. Ask the Lord to forgive the children of Israel when they sinned. That's a huge part of 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14, that we'll emphasize in our sermon this morning. pray that Israel's physical blessings would continue, and they would. There's a correlation between Israel being God's people, keeping his word, keeping his system of worship, and the blessings that would follow as a result. There's that correlation that's there. And he requested that the Lord would continue to answer prayers and other related requests. So he says, when your people who call by your name, they come before you at this particular place, and they say, please forgive us. Again, that's mentioned many times in the accounts here and also in Kings, then hear what they have to say and forgive them. So there's a constant emphasis upon God hearing them and responding to their prayers in the context of the temple worship. And so that's a huge part of what Solomon does in this context. It's very, very, very positive. So we're not going to read through all of this in 2 Chronicles chapter 6, starting in verse 3. He turns, he blesses the congregation, and he begins speaking. So starting in verse 4, and he goes throughout the rest of this. He gives the history lesson, the beginning of it, through verse 11. And then starting in verse 12, through the end of the chapter, which goes through verse 42. That's that long prayer of exhortation, dedication, thanksgiving, hopes that God's promises are going to continue. And so if you read through this, you see a huge, huge emphasis upon the uniqueness of God. There's no God in heaven who's just like you in verse 14. All the messages that God has conveyed to the prophets in the times past in verse 15, that God is bigger than this earth. He cannot be contained in the temple, let alone the physical creation. And so there's an acknowledgement of the greatness and the grandeur of God. And then constant emphasis on this, starting in verse 20. We pray that your eyes may be open toward this temple day and night, toward the place where you said you would put your name. Remember, we emphasized before, there's the singular emphasis of God's place in the city of Jerusalem. One of the things that's going to plague the northern kingdom is they weren't even worshiping the true God. They're worshiping images that they claim to be the gods that brought them out of the land of Egypt at Dan and Bethel. But even in the southern kingdom, where the system of worship is fairly consistent, I emphasize fairly consistent, they're worshiping other gods and they're worshiping God in other places. And the reforms of Hezekiah and Josiah put an end to that. But notice, this is the place that God has chosen. That's an issue that comes up when Jesus is talking to the woman at the well in John chapter 4. Your fathers, your ancestors say, Jerusalem is a place to worship. And it was. Jerusalem only. So the rest of that is talking about God's providence, God's promises, God's taking care of Israel. So chapter 7, he finishes the prayer. Solomon finishes the prayer. Fire comes down from heaven, consumes the burnt offering. Reminder of what we saw when God demonstrated victory of his prophet Elijah over the prophets of Baal in the contest. Fire came down and consumed the sacrifices, licked up all the water and everything. This is not a contest like we saw there, but a similar sort of thing. Sacrifice is consumed. The glory of God fills the temple, and because of that, the priests can't go in while that's going on. And the children of Israel saw this. They bowed down and worshiped God. So they saw some sense of physical manifestation of God. What all senses they experienced, we don't know all of those details, but they saw, they heard, similar to what we see in the day of Pentecost. They saw, they heard. Verses 4 and 11 talk about the continued sacrifices. Sacrifices started as they're beginning to move the ark towards temple out of the tabernacle, and they're going to continue during that process, and they're going to continue afterwards during this dedication of the temple. Lots and lots of sacrifices that are offered. They're chronicled and spelled out and detailed here. Rejoicing in the feast, they're all part of this. This is all of Solomon's direction behind all of this. The last part of the chapter is the covenant that God makes with Solomon. Now notice, we mentioned this before, God appears to Solomon twice. This is the second time. The first time he gave them wisdom and also gave him riches. He appears to him now in Kings. He appears to him again in 1 Kings chapter 11 saying, I'm upset with what you've done. The third appearance of God to Solomon in 1 Kings 11 details the sins that Solomon had committed. That's not going to be mentioned in this context. The first two addresses are going to be accentuated because there's a positive message in Chronicles. Not saying there's no sin whatsoever ever discussed, but it's much, much more positive and selective in emphasizing unity and worship and centering on God and God's character. All right, so the last part of it is a covenant God makes with Solomon. Similar to the many covenants he made, God promised to bless Israel as long as Solomon and Israel's faithful. Blessing was dependent upon their obedience. That's the same as their faithfulness. Faithfulness, obedience go hand in hand. If they didn't obey, they would be punished. Let me just say, that's a huge part of what the book of Deuteronomy is about. As they're about to go into the land of Canaan, Moses says, if you obey, God will bless you. If you disobey, no blessings. No blessings, they're withheld. Same message here. And if they continued in their wickedness, even after they were warned, they would ultimately perish as a nation. Again, in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses anticipates a time when the children of Israel, God speaking through Moses, anticipates a time when the children of Israel are not going to be faithful, and they're going to be scattered. And that scattering, that diaspora, is going to take place when the northern kingdom is taken into captivity, and then later when the southern kingdom is taken into captivity. So God appears to Solomon again and makes this covenant with him. Why is this going to happen in the future if it does happen? Last verse of chapter 7 tells us this happened. This is people speaking after the fact when God's uprooted them, verse 20, scattered them in different places, made them a proverb and a byword. They are a legend. They're about what they used to be, not what they are any longer. Why did it happen? God's anticipating the answer that's going to be given when people see this in the future, because they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, and embraced other gods, and worshiped them, and served them. Therefore, he has brought all this calamity on them. So in this context, there's an emphasis. Remember, the audience is primarily the children of Israel as they're reinstituting the system of worship during the time of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. We're about to get in to that specifically in Ezra and Nehemiah after we finish the readings of Chronicles. They're supposed to reestablish these things, but the promises are still good. You have to be faithful. If you're not faithful, God's not going to bless you. The nation went into captivity, northern first, Assyrian, southern next, Babylonian, and it was because they weren't worshiping God. They forsook God and embraced other gods. A reminder, in many places they were not only worshiping other gods, but in some places they stopped worshiping God and were worshiping other gods only. So we see in the book of Judges. All right, chapter 8. We've just got a few more minutes. We'll try to get a few more chapters done here. We'd like to get up close to 10 or 12, which will leave it a rough break of finishing half of what we need to do for our reading through 25 for this week, this last week, catching up to today. Chapter 8 lists many of the activities and accomplishments of Solomon. That is, they're not just limited to the building of the temple. That was a huge project involving tens of thousands of workers. But there were other building projects in and around the city of Jerusalem, and indeed throughout the land that Solomon was involved in. He was involved in establishing military outposts and fortifying them, involved in establishing a navy, so to speak, especially business ventures with others, by means of which many, many great riches and tributes came to Solomon, and so forth. So he built several cities, first point, won many battles, and again, not because he was the military leader, at least that's not accentuated as much as we see in the life of David, subdued the people of the land of Canaan and had them pay tribute, and that's part of the reason why the kingdom is going to be enlarged geographically, that is territorially. He offered burnt sacrifices, burnt offerings every day according to the commands of Moses. Remember, keep God's word, keep God's worship. That's what he's doing initially. Kept the courses of the Levites as David appointed them. That's a huge, huge thing that David did in establishing the various courses of the Levitical work schedule. We mentioned it's kind of an anticipation of a spreadsheet. All the priests, according to this particular course, served at this particular time, and so forth. That comes into play when John the Baptizer's father is in the temple. He's of the course of Abijah. And then Solomon and Hiram engaged in shipping enterprises. So we saw, I made a reference to that as well. So I'm not going to go through chapter 8. Mention these things are in much more detail, a lot of which we had already seen in Kings. Chapter 9, because of Solomon's wisdom and because of Solomon's wealth, it attracts a lot of attention. His fame spread around the world, and as a result of his fame, the nation of Israel did. Just a reminder, during the time of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, as they're reinstituting the system of worship, rebuilding the city of Jerusalem, and rebuilding the walls, there are challenges from Sanballat, Tobiah, and others who want to be part of the process. They're not allowed to be. And they send letters to the king in order to stop them. They said, listen, do you know what these people are like? There are a lot of great kings in the past of the nation of Israel who did nothing but cause trouble and conquer nations all over the world. I'm just summarizing there. So the point, they alluded to Israel's past as being a great nation. They're not a great nation now, but it looks like they're starting all that stuff all over again. And they're starting it by rebuilding their capital city, Jerusalem, the walls around the city, and rebuilding their whole temple system. And they're trying to go back to what they used to be like, David, and during David's time and Solomon's time. And so that's enough to stop temporarily what was going on, that they are going to go back to what they used to be. Solomon's fame has residual impact years down the line. David's fame and military conquests and so forth, the tribute that comes to many comes to Israel from many nations, years later people are going to remember that. Oh, they're trying to reestablish what they used to be. Now, they never have a king sitting on the throne again. Jeremiah prophesied that. There's a kingly lineage. But the assumption is they're trying to go back to that. And that was enough for them to get the work temporarily stopped. So Solomon's fame in this context is going to have residual impact years down the road during the time of restoration. People from all over the places come and ask Solomon questions because of the wisdom that he had. Examples of that are given in Kings. And one of those that came was the Queen of Sheba. She heard all these great things. And after she sees Solomon, sees all the great wealth, see all the building projects and his wisdom, she says, that's not even half of what I've heard. You know, he's even greater than that. And so all of these things tell us that Solomon was blessed as God promised to bless him. And residually through Solomon, ultimately through God, obviously, the nation is going to be blessed. And so how much wealth he has, we've talked about that a little bit before, the great cities that he built, not just the temple, but also his own house. That's also chronicled in this chapter. Last part of it talks about Solomon's death, and Rehoboam, his son, becomes the next king in Israel after that. So I don't want to go into chapter 10. We've gone about 40, 45 minutes or so. So I'll take up with that in the review that we'll do later that will be posted online. Incidentally, all of these lessons are hosted online at the Bible, thebible.net/EDWG, where EDWG stands for Every Day with God. And so all of the audio files, all of these slides are already up. In fact, the material for Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, which we'll get into this week, those files are already up. And then the audios and the slides for this morning's sermon and the audio for this night's summation as we continue up through chapter 25, they'll also be loaded there as well. All right, I will try to correct the horizontal versus vertical orientation of this streaming. What I'll do later is I'll download that and turn it sideways and fix it, and we'll make sure I'll take care of that for our period of worship this morning. All right, let's draw to a close. Thanks for joining us either online or in person.